better for farmers or for those who are dispossessed of their land or are unemployed.
One of the major challenges facing Africa today is the presence of foreign military bases, especially those established by Western countries with a history of colonialism and exploitation. The U.S. and France are at the forefront of conducting and establishing military bases in Africa. The Western military bases are unpopular in Africa, with many citizens saying they believe these bases are a source of insecurity. A Ghanaian woman explains here on why she opposes U.S. military presence in her country.
I'm a mother, and we know what these Americans do. We know that these Americans have a lot of enemies. And by coming to settle their base here, we are not safe. And that's the reason why I have to join this campaign, to create awareness.
Now, recently, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said that the United States should consider moving its military headquarters overseeing Africa to the continent from Germany to better tackle what he called growing violence in the region. Now, Buhari's remarks have been sharply criticized by many inside and outside Nigeria. Professor Monene, is it in the interest of African countries to have foreign military bases dotted around the continent?
It may not be in their long-run interest or in the African interest to have all these bases, competing bases, not just because they're competing bases of various powerful countries trying to show their might as they perceptibly protect their perceived interests, geostrategic interests, using Africa as the place or the base for that purpose. So it will have to come from within the African countries in collaboration with their regional bodies and the African Union to agree that the bases are not helpful to individual countries and to the African continent.
Thank you for that insight, Professor Monene.
African Union Agenda 2063, a shared strategic framework for inclusive growth and sustainable development, was adopted in January of 2015 by the 24th African Union Assembly of Heads of State and Government. It is basically a blueprint and master plan for transforming Africa into the global powerhouse of the future. Is the African Union on track to achieve the objectives of Agenda 2063, which aims to transform the continent into a major global power?
The potential is there, but it is far from being realized. And in part because of the reasons we've given from the other answers, the divisions within, the external forces that would like to keep the African continent divided and fighting, And then when you come to the high command, the African high command, we have some organizations that have some military aspects, but not very strong because they are also reliant on external extra-continental forces.
This year, President Cyril Ramaphosa participated in a webinar marking the Africa Day. The webinar was organized by the Prime Minister of Jamaica under the theme, A Destiny of Peace, Prosperity, Strength, and Unity. Ramaphosa had this to say on the importance of Africa Day, which brings together people of African descent from across the world.
Today we celebrate the ties that bind us together, ties that no ocean, be it the Atlantic Ocean or any other, no slave trader, no war, and no pandemic can tear asunder.
Professor Manji, you have the closing comments in our show today. Now, is Africa Day given the attention it deserves in Africa?
But you see, there are two different kinds of Pan-Africanism. The Africa Union represents the Pan-Africanism of an elite, of the oligarchs of our continent. Whereas on the ground, there are people who are organizing and connecting citizens to citizens. And it's that kind of connection between citizens and those who are perhaps the most disenfranchised, the what Fanon called the wretched of the earth, who are the ones who can benefit most from that connection, Pan-African-wide.
Well, thanks a lot, Professor Feroz Manji of the Radio Press, for your incisive analysis. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Now, welcome to this segment of our program, which brings you interesting news from different parts of Africa. Now, today we are going to Nigeria, where recently an athlete who was 8 months pregnant clinched a Taekwondo gold medal at the country's National Sports Festival. We've talked to her days after the event. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself, some background about your sporting career.
Good afternoon. My name is Mrs. Idris Aminat Matepo. I'm 26 years old, graduate of University of Lagos, studied human kinesis and health education. My sporting career started when I was pretty young. My dad is a Taekwondo coach, and Taekwondo has been a family thing, you know. Introduced Taekwondo to us, and he encouraged us to train. So growing up, I got very fond of training. I love to train. I'm always happy when I have to go for training. So it's been like that up to this moment. So I'll say basically, Taekwondo is in the family, so that's why I've been on track. Yeah.
Okay, Aminat, how is your experience as a hijabi woman doing professional sports?
Yeah, as a hijabi using hijab and participating in professional sports, it's been very interesting for me personally, because one of the reasons why I'm still in sports, why I'm still participating actively, is because Taekwondo allows the use of hijab globally, internationally, anywhere you want to go, as far as you want to go, Taekwondo allows the use of hijab. So for me personally, it's always interesting. I'm always happy. I'm representing Islam. You know, I'm out there. I'm having fun. I'm doing what I like. And I'm still properly dressed. Not just my hijab. You know, the Taekwondo outfit itself is really modest. It's covered. It's big. It's not tight. You know, so it allows me to be very confident and free to do whatever I have to do. So for me, it's one of the most interesting parts of being an athlete. That have used my hijab, it doesn't surprise me.
Now, there was mixed reaction after you attended the competition while 8 months pregnant. Now, how do you feel about yourself? Why did you decide to take part in the competition, and weren't you worried about the health of your unborn child?
You know, people are entitled to their opinion. You can say whatever you want to say. No one is going to hold that against you. So, what is most important is the fact that my husband, my family members, you know, they gave their consent and go ahead. That's one. Secondly, I have been certified by medical professionals that, okay, you are physically fit, you can go ahead, because it's something I have been doing before I got married, before I got pregnant. You know, my body is already used to it. It's something I've been doing, I've been practicing. So when I got pregnant, I started training, it doesn't feel different. Then we had to seek permission from the federation as well, Nigerian Taekwondo Federation, just to be sure that there is no rule against a pregnant woman participating at the event. So, and we were sure that the World Taekwondo Federation has no conduct against it. So we had no reason to be worried. As far as I am okay, there was no reason to fear. I believe in God that my baby and I will be fine. That's how we decided to move ahead.
Well, by the way, this interview was conducted while she was pregnant, and now the good news is that Aminat Idris has already given birth to a bouncing baby girl. Well, congratulations, Aminat, for the little angel, and God bless you all. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. We hope you enjoyed the show. It would be great hearing from you, so send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Recently, a group of child rights experts have strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding 8 parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Alan Rock, who was Canada's ambassador to the UN from 2003 to 2006 and served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, titled UN Should Stop Playing Politics with Children's Lives. The article was published by the Al Jazeera website. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Children around the world suffer the consequences of war. They're routinely killed, maimed, recruited to fight, and otherwise abused. In 2020, the United Nations reported more than 25,000 such grave violations in the previous year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has powerful tools at his disposal to pressure those responsible to end such abuses, but he is failing to use them, often placing politics above children's lives. Over the past 20 years, the UN Security Council has put in place a framework to protect children in conflict zones. It requires the Secretary General to report every year on grave violations against children, including killing and maiming, recruiting child soldiers, sexual violence, and bombing schools. The Secretary General is required to attach a list of those responsible to his report. The list of shame, as it is sometimes called, is the linchpin for holding parties accountable for grave violations. When used as intended, the list has been a remarkably effective tool. Governments and non-state armed actors alike dread the stigma of being listed and are motivated to engage with the UN on steps they can take to end their abuses and be removed from the list. Alan Rock wrote, "I have seen for myself the power of the list. In 2006, I served as a UN Special Advisor on Children and Armed Conflict in Sri Lanka, where I met with dozens of heartbroken families whose children had been abducted by the Tamil Tigers or the government-linked Tamil Makal Pulkal, that is TMVP, and forced to fight in Sri Lanka's civil war. The TMVP was added to the list of shame in 2006. Following intensive dialogue with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, it signed and implemented an action plan to end the abductions, and it was removed from the list in 2011. Rock said, "At that time, there was a palpable sense of optimism among those of us working to protect children in armed conflicts. We saw the Secretary General's list as a strong instrument to root out practices like recruiting child soldiers. And for many years it was. In addition to the TMVP in Sri Lanka, the list shamed many others into changing their ways. Among them, the Maoists in Nepal, government forces in Chad, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. However, in recent years, decisions about listing have become increasingly politicized, undermining the list's potential to protect children. For example, in 2016, the UN's then Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, removed the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from his list. Even though coalition airstrikes massacred more than 450 children and injured hundreds the previous year. The reason? Saudi threats to withdraw UN funding. Although Secretary General Guterres returned the Saudi coalition to his list in 2017, he removed it again in 2020, despite the UN's own findings that the coalition was responsible for at least 222 child casualties the previous year. Guterres has also removed the Myanmar Armed Forces, the Tatmadaw, from the list for recruiting and using children, despite hundreds of documented violations in 2019 and 2020. Alan Rock noted, "These betrayals prompted me to join a group of international children's rights experts to conduct a systematic review of the Secretary General's listing and delisting decisions over the past decade and to make recommendations to end the politicization of this process." The author of this article said, "The extent of the discrepancies we found was shocking. There is a clear mismatch between information about violations documented by the UN itself, and the groups and government forces on the list. Our review identified dozens of cases in which multiple violations did not lead to listing or in which listing decisions reflected unexplained inconsistencies." Rock continued, "Our analysis also found that government forces have often had a free pass for committing violations. Of 8 parties responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children, in a one-year period that were not listed, 6 were governments, including state armed forces or occupation forces in Afghanistan, the DRC, the Israeli regime, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia. Israeli troops, terrorists, and occupation forces in Afghanistan have each been responsible for thousands of child injuries and deaths since 2014, but have never been listed." Alan Rock concluded, "Protecting children among the most vulnerable in war should be a politics-free zone. Their interests should be paramount when calling out abuses. Secretary General Guterres needs to address the issues we have identified and produce a credible, accurate, and evidence-based list in his upcoming annual report. Treating parties to conflict based on their conduct, not their political influence, is the only way to restore the list as a powerful tool in responding to grave violations against children in war." Recently, a group of child rights experts has strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding eight parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. In a report, experts from Watch List on Children, an international child rights group, said at least eight parties to conflicts were found responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children in a single year, but were excluded from the blacklist. The report said there were numerous discrepancies and omissions in listing decisions, as well as unwarranted delisting decisions, noting that the UN Security Council's 2001 resolution establishing the list to protect children from the horrors of war is being seriously undermined and could result in putting children at even greater risk. The report said the Secretary General's 2015 annual report acknowledges that the number of children killed by the Israeli regime in 2014 was the third highest in the world, and the number of schools damaged or destroyed was the highest anywhere in the world that year. And yet, the Israeli regime has not been listed in the report's annexes. It added that at the time, the news media reported that the Zionist regime and the United States conducted intense lobbying to prevent the regime's blacklisting. The child rights experts also cited annual reports that have repeatedly found the Israeli regime forces responsible for high levels of Palestinian child casualties, including over 1,525 killed and maimed in 2020 alone. They added, yet Israeli regime forces have yet to be included in the annexed list of violations. According to the AP, co-author Yangi Lee, former chair of the committee that monitors implementation of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, said, "We are calling on the Secretary General to urgently address these problems and commit to hold all countries and groups responsible for violations against children accountable without fear or favor." In response to the report, UN spokesman Stephanie Dujarric said Secretary General Antonio Guterres stands by the report's conclusions, expressing willingness to engage with relevant partners in how to improve the system. Benyam Dwight Mesmore, another co-author of the report, urged the UN to ensure that the list of perpetrators it issues is more credible, accurate, complete, an evidence-based, or risk pulling apart this unique tool for the protection of children caught in war. The report also said the Saudi-led war coalition against Yemen was delisted in 2020 for killing and maiming children in the Arab country, despite being responsible for a documented 222 child casualties during the reporting period. It noted, with this delisting, the Saudi-led coalition has been removed from the Secretary General's list altogether. Citing the Secretary General's reports that said the Saudi-led coalition was delisted due to a sustained significant decrease in the number of violations they committed, the rights experts said such argument runs counter to the established delisting criteria. They maintained this runs counter to the delisting criteria established in 2010 and the Security Council's stated expectations that listing is based on whether or not grave violations against children took place in violation of international obligations. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, the Saudi war on Yemen has killed 250,000 people, including women and children, since it was launched in March 2015 with the aim of restoring the Riyadh-friendly government of former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I welcome all the honorable gentlemen and I ask Allah, the Exalted, to accept your efforts and endeavors, and to bestow his blessings and mercy on everyone. I deem it necessary to thank the current members of the Assembly of Experts who held their last meeting and who carried out valuable tasks during their term of responsibility. Primarily, they held numerous meetings, almost two times more than the previous term. They paid attention to important issues in these meetings and they carried out many other tasks. It is necessary for the public opinion inside the country to be informed of these moves and measures. For example, good tasks have been carried out in the secretariat of this assembly, such as publishing the Islamic Government magazine. Many editions of this magazine have been published, which involve good and research-based issues. A research center has been established where certain issues are brought up and examined. In this center, scholarly and expert meetings have been held on issues related to the Assembly of Experts. Moreover, scholarly programs related to the issue of Wilayat al-Faqih and the leadership have been prepared with the cooperation of the IRIB. These programs have been broadcasted for the people. These are the valuable tasks that have been carried out. The manifestos of the Assembly of Experts in each term are very reasonable and they include important discussions which indicate the orientation of the scholarly and political personalities of the country towards the fundamental issues of the revolution and the Islamic Republic. I have seen their manifesto in this meeting. Therefore, we should thank each and every one of the gentlemen in this assembly. What I want to discuss today is the issue of the position of the Assembly of Experts. In fact, the Assembly of Experts is a great source of support for the Islamic Republic. It is the spiritual wealth fund of the Islamic Republic. It is a source of support and a spiritual fund, and it should be prepared energetically and up to date when necessary.
To Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Britain and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 international summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. And we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
Vardia, it was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the US president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through US politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. The whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, which was the Good Friday Agreement, which binding international agreement, which they've signed on to. And the terms that they've agreed for the to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, I mean, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end result on this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties, and the utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, you know, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet himself, you know, yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson, he claims that EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues, and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain. But again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much-wanted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this exit, premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, you know, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs. You know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which is now gradually going to get exposed.
Go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU's threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson and his posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreement says they agreed be actually implemented. That, you know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over and over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland. They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And you know, the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. Much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, UK's, rather the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whoever is constructing this, whether they actually want, from the British policymakers, like whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, you know, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folk that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically. You know, 20-30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions, and they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French president Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered that they could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals, but they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs. And it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. We didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, the real tragedy of Britain is there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know, the union was a Conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. But again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line, and whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in, you know, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line, you know, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc., that's also going to be, you know, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. You know, Brexit, you know, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe. You know, how that was one thing which, you know, also was mooted. One of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone, the strength of its currency was higher. You know, but again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then of course the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, you know, the labour shortage that I briefly mentioned would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants who from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants, there's been a massive exodus in I think almost some folks I've had are up to a million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain, you know. You know, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence industry, well, the intelligence networks,
sure.
You know, the sharing of information. Which was there on the cards, that's all going to be much, much more difficult to sort of access. They're not going to be as freely giving in
okay.
that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that the foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbo. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.